Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Ray Graff, in for Alan Shartok today. It's a Medical Monday, and joining us to address issues of mental health, substance abuse, things like that, Dr. Jennifer Michaels, Medical Director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency. Dr. Michaels is also an assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts and a physician in the psychiatry and behavioral health department of Berkshire Medical Center in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. She has been analyzing me now for several minutes, and it's well, I'm trying to stay comfortable. Dr. Michaels, welcome back to Medical Monday. Nice to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
Sorry Alan could not be here today, but he should be back by the next time, probably by next Monday, he'll be doing Medical Monday again. The number to call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also get in touch with us online. You can post comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, WAMC.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio, or you can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us at voxpop@WAMC.org. Before we get into the enormous question I have, enormous, overarching, massive question that I have for you.
I'm shaking over here. You realize that.
Okay, well, yeah, this is not like 60 minutes. You'll be fine. You wanted to talk a little bit about the 4th of July and the dangers.
Yes, I do, because it's actually our most dangerous holiday. You know, out of all the holidays we celebrate each year, it's the most dangerous one.
Fireworks and whatnot, or drinking, or what is it?
You have all the answers. Yes, that's right.
I have all the experience.
So, you know, when they say don't play with fireworks, there's a good reason, because young people show up at the emergency room with, you know,
wounds
and body parts off. Yep. And the alcohol is associated with motor vehicle accidents and deaths. We know that. And people are traveling. So we see a lot of car crashes. And what can we do? We want to have fun. We want everyone to have fun. So you can do things like get a designated driver. You may not have fireworks. There are sizzlers and things like that that
sure.
you can use. And really try to have fun maybe in a physical way with exercise and swimming, and not make it a day of just drinking from dawn to dusk.
Is it one of those holidays that I'm sure you see often in your line of work where one... There is an urge to almost feel compelled. I have to have a good time on this day.
Yes.
I have to do it.
And it's an anniversary in a way. It's, remember what we did last year.
Yeah.
And we do it every year. And so we're going to keep doing it. And I think that's, you know, that's a dangerous behavior. Just because you did it doesn't mean you have to do it again. And it can be very compulsive. And I've encouraged people I treat to try something different. And oftentimes, if you celebrate and you don't drink a lot, you remember what you did. So it's more it's more fun.
it's much less stressful to try to figure out not to try to figure out what you did the day before,
yes.
than to know what you did before. Well, this is very true.
Mm-hmm.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. You're off the hook right now on this huge, overarching question I have for you, because we have a phone caller, and we'll go to the phones. Dr. Jennifer Michaels is our guest. Barbara, you're first.
Hi.
Hi, Barbara.
Is it me?
Yes.
Okay. I have a question about being in mourning. My husband died recently, and I have been hollered at by a family member about snap out of it, crying isn't going to help, and I mean, isn't it normal to kind of fall apart when you lose a life partner?
Barbara, first I want to say how sorry I am that you lost your husband. How many years were you married?
39.
So he was your life partner. And yes, you're right. It's very normal to fall apart, to have times of uncontrollable crying and sleep issues and appetite issues and just difficulty functioning.
And tiredness.
Yeah. And everything may feel like more of an effort, the things you used to do.
Yeah, I
hear you're getting tearful just talking about it.
Yeah, so, I feel like a failure because I can't snap out of this.
Barbara, you're not a failure. You're doing something very normal, which is mourning your husband and remembering him and thinking about him and trying to figure out how to live without him with you. And so it's very normal during the mourning process. And by the way, mourning can go on for anywhere from weeks to months to up to a year that we see people having sleep issues, tearfulness, a lot of reminiscing and dreams. And people I know even have dreams and the person they love visits them in their dreams. That's perfectly normal. And what you need is love and understanding. So you can tell whoever is kind of picking on you that you spoke to a doctor who said, do not pick on me. You need to be very loving and understanding. When you feel up to it, Barbara, you need to start scheduling your day. Because what happens with mourning is it's almost like there's a vacuum, there's a void, and just sadness fills that. So if you can start your day by walking out of the house, getting some exercise, being with friends, pets are wonderful. If you have a dog, taking care of your dog.
I have a cat.
Okay.
So he's in mourning, too.
I bet he is in mourning.
He is. He doesn't understand where Daddy went.
Yeah. So hug that cat, and every day have something that kind of grounds you to life and living. If you have grandchildren, make sure to see them.
I have been working my butt off, trying to get things straightened out, and I've been busy, and I've worn myself out physically and emotionally, and I'm in a lot of physical pain, and I just keep going. And one of these days, I'm going to crash.
Well, so everything in moderation. So it's great that you're staying busy, but you also need time to rest. I also suggest you call hospice. A lot of people don't know this, but hospice will offer you therapy to cope with the loss, to go through the mourning process. So you're not alone in it. And it's good to have a guide in that process. So please give them a call and just know what you're doing is very normal. There's nothing wrong. And I don't know anyone who just snaps out of it. So I'm on your side.
Barbara, thanks a lot for the call. Does the mourning the mourning process is different in every culture and society. Are there cultures where you think it may work better than it does here, where a certain amount of stoicism is sort of par for the course, where you let it all hang out and you get it out of your system?
I think that it's a catharsis to do that. It's definitely a catharsis to cry, to howl even. People do all kinds of things. And I think whatever feels right for you is the right way to mourn. There's no way to kind of contain it. But you're right. In different societies, they have a method for their mourning.
You mentioned when you were talking to Barbara that, these things happen up to a year, the mourning process. After a year, then is it something else?
Well, it's not like, 366 days, okay, now it's a problem, but it should start to dissipate over time, that life reaches a new normal. If someone has ongoing depression, difficulty sleeping, and has worsening symptoms, like feeling like they want to join their deceased loved one. It's more of a pathological kind of mourning, and that person should go seek help. Because I said, okay, give them a year, but if they're going down the tubes, they've lost a lot of weight, they can't function, they see no reason to go on living, that's when you call in the psychologist, the social worker, the psychiatrist, because it may be more of a dangerous process of mourning, not something that in a way is fruitful, the working through the loss.
Dr. Jennifer Michaels is our guest. It's Medical Monday. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. Deborah in Phoenicia, you're on.
Hi. I'm having a terrible time with menopause. I'm sorry I have to do a girl problem on the air.
Well,
but it's never happened to me before. I'm 54 years old. I'm 23 years sober. I don't have any way out here. I don't like to take drugs. And I'm having hot flashes. I'm sorry to do this on the air because it's a female problem.
Don't apologize. Let it all hang out,
Okay. But, these hot flashes are this hot weather we've been having. I can't even step outside. People are telling me, go on hormone therapy. I don't really want to do it. I'm sober. I'm a sober person. I understand about hormone therapy, but is there a way for me to ride this out naturally? What can I do? This is horrible. I haven't had my period in 6 months. Sorry, I have to do this on a male show. But
hey, I'm a female. We can. You know what? It's good for them to hear what we go through. It's fine, Deborah. So there are lots of things you can do, and some of them have to do with diet. And I'm not an expert in this, but there are certain foods that you can eat that will help with estrogen levels. Like soy and things like that. But I would actually, I am not an expert, and I would ask you to go online and Google food for menopause and see what comes up. There are ways to kind of balance out your hormonal dysregulation. Okay, that's one thing. I think it would be good to have a consultation with a doctor and just know what your options are. You know, it's not mandatory that you go on pills, but there may be a medication that you could take temporarily. And then as far as your sobriety, it's wonderful that you're staying sober through this very challenging time. You know, you're an example for other people. I would consider asking other women who have been through this what has helped them.
Is it a danger to one? She had mentioned that she doesn't want hormone replacement therapy because in some regard it may affect her sobriety that she's had for 23 years. Is that a medical procedure, and really, would that be an issue?
So that's a great, great question, because many people in sobriety think, I will relapse if I'm taking a pill. If my doctor prescribes Prozac, I'm not sober anymore. And that's a fallacy. You know, if you're taking a prescribed medication that you take correctly and do not abuse, you're sober. You're not in relapse mode. You know, what I say to people is, you know, you could abuse Motrin and be in relapse, yeah. You know, or you can take, some people have pain meds and take them appropriately and they're not in relapse. It's how you engage your medication.
Dr. Jennifer Michaels is our guest, and we will be back with more of your calls coming up on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Back in a flash.
Support comes from St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers, Poughkeepsie, serving the healthcare needs of the community, including trauma and emergency care and the Center for Robotic Surgery, sfhospital.org. American Meditation Institute, Averill Park, New York, offering meditation classes for beginners working to reduce stress and enhance their health, americanmeditation.org. And Veterinary Emergency and Specialty Hospital, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, providing 24-hour emergency and critical care for dogs and cats every day, including all holidays. VESHDeerfield.com.
one 800 348 2551 is our telephone number here on Vox Pop. You can email us as well at voxpop@wamc.org. Jennifer Michaels is our guest. We're talking about mental health and addiction. And all right, I'll just bring this on you now. And this is the big question that
okay.
I came up with as I was having a cigarette. You know, you talk about what?
You said the cigarette word. I said I wasn't going to bother you.
Well, that's all right.
Okay.
It's no secret.
We're going to talk about that later.
Oh,
though.
No, we're
okay,
not.
Okay, right?
So anyway, the thing is mental health. We talk about people getting healthy and mental health. Who decides what is mentally ill and who decides what is mental health? Is it a consensus? How do you know? How do you take into account individual differences?
Great question. And it's very complicated because, you know, there's no blood test. There's no X-ray that really tells us this is a healthy mental person. You know, mental health is good here versus bad. And so it's more symptomatic.
Yeah.
And when I look at the history of mental health, we know that homosexuality was considered mental illness.
Right.
Until, you know, fairly recently. And other behaviors that were not the so-and-so norm were considered mental illness. So there are a group of people, the American Psychiatric Association has a review board that identifies mental illness and the criteria for diagnosis. And it's changed recently. We now have a Diagnostic and Statistical Manual number 5,
uh-huh.
Fifth generation.
I see.
And the fifth generation, you know, homosexuality is not an illness anymore, although in DSM-1 it was.
In this society. Perhaps in another society it may be different.
Right. But it informs us about mental illness, that it could be part of the culture or where the culture is evolving. So it is fascinating as a psychiatrist.
It's fascinating. You know, you hear stories in communist nations in the Cold War, if you protested too heavily against the government, you're mentally ill. We're sending you to a re-education.
Yes.
And so it seems to me that whoever makes that decision holds an awful lot of power.
Yeah, and maybe too much power. So for example, in certain cultures, if you hear voices or you believe unusual things, you may be a shaman.
Right.
In this country, you have schizophrenia. So, in a way, as a psychiatrist, I love that fluidity, but it's a struggle sometimes to normalize symptoms, help people to get the help they need, but also not pathologize a person who may be eccentric or a little unusual.
Yeah. But when it comes down to you one-on-one with a patient, it really comes down to a game time decision for you. I mean, you have to go with what you think, right?
Well, and I like to partner with my patients. So I think also humility is very important. I don't like to be the kind of doctor who says, you have this and this is the treatment, but more that you seem to have these symptoms and what do you think of that? And some patients absolutely deny that they could ever be bipolar, or how could you think that I'm an alcoholic, or they can be grateful that we finally figured out why they feel so bad.
Mm, interesting. 1-800, you did very well on the huge question, which I tried to stump you with. Very well done.
You're just a nice person.
Thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551. Ray Graff in for Alan Shartok. It's Medical Monday. Jennifer Michaels is our guest. Gary in West Springfield, you're up.
Yes. Hey, I'm calling from West Springfield. I've got a 30-year-old grandson that's had severe epilepsy for the past 15, 20 years. Mm. His form of epilepsy is where he's developed a real weakness in his legs where he falls all the time. He'll get 10, 15 stitches after when he goes down. He'll bang his head against all kinds of furniture, you know, wooden desks and everything. I end up taking him to the hospital for stitches. Over the years, he has fallen so much. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think it's affected his brain from concussions and things, where he's become very dangerous. He's become paranoid. He won't see a psychiatrist. He won't take psych medications. He's more or less, you know, totally disabled. He lives at home. He won't see a psychiatrist or anything. Last time we had an episode, I took him into the hospital, and I wanted him kept for evaluation, and they refused to do it. Any idea on what we can do to get help for him? I know the state has, you know, they don't have the hospitals anymore that they used to. They put people in halfway homes and things like that. We're at our wits' end. Any idea how we can address it?
So first of all, I'm so sorry your family is suffering with this. It sounds like it's been going on a long time.
Yes.
And it's not like you have a good treatment plan that's working.
No. We go to the neurologist, and he doesn't want to address it. He just wants to address the epilepsy problems.
I would recommend a second opinion at a large center in Boston. And there are specialty clinics that deal with epilepsy, traumatic brain injury, and we know that neurology and psychiatry overlap. And if you're not comfortable with the current treaters, get other treaters, because he needs the help. It's just not meeting his needs. You need a higher level of care. That would be my recommendation. And certainly, I know neurologists who will prescribe antidepressants or anti-seizure medications, and a good neurologist, a comfortable neurologist will do that for him.
He refuses to take them.
He refuses to take them.
He refuses to see a psychiatrist.
Well, what about medication provided by a neurologist?
Well, he will only take medication from his epilepsy, and I don't think the neurologist feels comfortable in describing it because he kind of just like blows us away when you get into the discussions.
Okay,
he
so
doesn't want to address it.
I would look into either Beth Israel or Mass General. They will have an epilepsy center, and they will do everything in one site. And that may be a way for him to have a consultation that's more comprehensive.
All right, Gary, thanks a lot. We've got to move it on, but I appreciate the call. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Jennifer Michaels is our guest. Amy in Rensselaer, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a question. Is it normal practice for doctors to test a patient's urine sample for cannabis without his knowledge, and then to threaten him with refusing to treat him later if it happens again?
It sounds like maybe you can give us a little details about this situation before we...
Sure, okay, my husband went in for a normal physical. He was asked to give a urine sample. They discovered marijuana in his urine, which he uses maybe once a week, if at all. And then they said, if this happens again, you cannot come back here. He's retired. He's 70 years old.
Mm-hmm. So I know that there are pain clinics that will now routinely perform urine toxicologies, and on those tests, sometimes cannabis will come up. It's, in my experience, usually people are told beforehand that they're going to give a urine sample that will be tested for potential drugs of abuse. I don't know the situation. Also, there are treatment agreements that patients now sign with their physicians, and on that long list of treatment agreements may be urine toxicology testing. I don't know if your husband signed that, but that is becoming a factor, especially if your doctor is prescribing opioids to your husband. If he's prescribing opioids to your husband and finds cannabis in his urine, there will be some concern.
You mean interaction?
Interaction, or for example, if I were to prescribe opioids to a patient, I don't want them using other substances that could impair cognition or functioning or driving.
Right.
So that would be a reason that perhaps that doctor doesn't want to continue. I don't know all the details, obviously, but your husband might want to find if he sign a treatment agreement, and probably that treatment agreement included urine testing.
I see. All okay, because right. It seemed to us that this was happening without his consent, and it seemed like such an invasion.
Well, I would ask you to...
Yes, he is on an opioid, and I guess that must be what's happened here.
Yeah, that's very common now, because we're really struggling with an opioid epidemic, and some people need it, and some people are taking them and running into problems. So I would just ask you to speak to the doctor and ask for clarification.
Good.
Okay. Good
thank
luck.
Thank you very much. That's helpful.
Amy, thank you. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Dr. Jennifer Michaels is our guest. And we go to Russ in Malta. Russ, you're on.
Oh, hi there. Listen, I have a question. I'm 58 years old, seemingly normal guy. About 6 months ago, my plate seemed to get really full, and I just started suffering from some really uncontrollable bouts of anxiety. I started having night terrors. I couldn't sleep. I was up all hours of the night. I started sort of projecting all these bad feelings and stuff. And so being a healthy guy, and also sort of odd, I guess, I've been sober for 15 years, so I've been really hesitant about taking any medication myself. But finally, after going to see my doctor, he put me on Celexa, and I don't know what the normal case is, but in my case, it was like a miracle drug. Mm-hmm. I sleep all night. I don't have these thoughts anymore. I don't have, you know, it's worked so well. And I guess what I wanted to know is it possible to get weaned off that at some point in time? And are there any real side effects to it right now?
What is Celexa first?
Oh, good question. So Celexa is an antidepressant. It's one of those SSRIs, serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors. It's related to Prozac and things like that.
All right.
So first of all, I am so happy to hear your story, because you've been sober a long time. I mean, you're a picture of success. It sounds like you had a lot of stress and difficult symptoms, and you sought medical attention, and you didn't fall into that trap of, well, I'm sober in recovery, so I can't take any medicines. That's just not true. And, you were put on a medicine, Celexa, which is not a drug of abuse. It's a therapeutic medication, and you're benefiting from the effects. As far as should you stop it or not, after someone has suffered with depression or anxiety, we recommend that you stay on it for about a year, and then with your doctor, make that decision. Do we continue on it, or do I slowly taper off?
Right. Okay. Because I'm seeing, I had 6 or 8 visits with a psychologist, which actually helped too, because I'm like the woman who called you who's in menopause. It's sort of an odd show to be talking publicly, but quite honestly, part of the problem was my wife is going through menopause, and her changes have really affected, you know, my life as well. So I think that was part of the things that was going through my life at the time.
I think we need a menopause and mental health show, okay?
All right.
So that's the next one coming up. It's great to get this info.
I will tell you candidly, at first I thought I was going crazy, and since I've taken a selection, I've told my doctor this. It made such a difference that it almost scared me. I mean,
yeah. Well, a lot of times when we're suffering and we have stress, we're not sleeping, we're anxious, we really don't appreciate how bad it is. And then when we get relief and we're back to ourselves, I mean, it's so dramatic. So I encourage people who are suffering to just go talk to someone who can help, a professional who's licensed, and get the help you need, because you don't have to suffer.
Made all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Russ, thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. An open line now if you want to talk to Dr. Jennifer Michaels. So, menopause.
Yes.
Let's talk about it.
Okay.
In addition, then, Russ was talking about the collateral damage.
Yes.
And what can I expect in my household in 10 or 15 years? Is it really that huge of an upheaval?
It can be. It isn't always. But some women suffer with irritability, anxiety, anger, insomnia. Some people have terrible sweats and cold, you know, flashes.
If they have that already, then you can assume it'll get better? Kidding. Sorry,
yeah,
honey.
I think you're in trouble now.
I'm only joking.
It's variable. I think being very understanding, and some people do opt for dietary supplements or changes in diet that kind of boost estrogen during that time. And some people do go on hormone replacement therapy. But it can be a tough time.
Psychologically as well as physically?
Yes. And imagine sleeping poorly night after night, feeling more irritable, feeling not like yourself. And antidepressants can help during that time. They've been shown to help with the mood symptoms, the anxiety of menopause. So and people can go on them, get through menopause. They may choose to continue or taper off afterwards.
Do you find the stress level in family members of those going through menopause is markedly higher? I mean, this interests me.
Yeah. And you said the collateral.
Yeah.
We actually call people who don't have the problem but live with the problem, you know, one degree of separation, the collaterals, because they suffer too. Whether the person has menopause or depression or anxiety,
yeah.
When you love someone and they're not feeling well, you suffer too. So we could, you know, we could see the family and how do we cope with mom who's incredibly irritable or crying more? How can we support her?
1-800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Jennifer Michaels, our guest. It is a Medical Monday. Ray Graff in for Alan Chartok. Let's go to John in Stockbridge. John, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about marijuana use relative to children. I was recently in a divorce, and I have 3 kids. And the kid's mom has lost her job, and she's a really heavy marijuana user. Pot use is fairly endemic in the Berkshires, where I live. And I'm just wondering how I handle it, because the woman does a lot of the alienation behaviors that you hear about in divorce. But it's almost impossible to reason with her because she's constantly stoned. So could you let me know?
Okay.
It's very complicated. I feel for you, John. I have treated people in similar circumstances, and sometimes part of the divorce agreement is that the ex has to have testing done. And if the ex is going to be with the children, the test results have to be negative for drugs of abuse. You know, and so that people bring their exes into court and complain, and they will, you know, have witnesses or evidence. And if you're extremely concerned, I suggest you talk to a lawyer.
Okay. But how about in terms of dealing with the kids? Because I had heard that in divorce, it's best not to stigmatize the other parent, and the children do need both parents.
Mm-hmm.
For all practical purposes, what is the norm in the Berkshires? The woman of which I'm referring to is, you know, a widely accepted person in the community. It's just when sort of the intimate light of family and divorce comes on it that this becomes a sort of an atypical problem. Because really, in the Berkshires, there's tons of people riding around stoned all the time. That's just what happens here. So I don't really know if that... I'm not really trying to stigmatize that. I'm just trying to figure out how I deal with my kids.
Okay. All right.
So it's tricky, but you know, I live in the Berkshires too, and I don't drive around stoned, and my friends don't drive around stoned, and my family doesn't either. So sometimes when you're in the thick of it, it feels like everyone's doing it, and I hear this from my kids. You know, everyone's doing this, and they feel like you know they're the one person not. And why do I have such nerdy parents? not everyone is doing it, and I think it's part of a culture and certain, you know, little. Parts of the Berkshires. So I think it's important to be clear that you don't want your children smoking marijuana. I would assume that's what you're getting at.
No. My problem is actually how to deal with them. Like, for instance, if there's a problem vis-a-vis the divorce, or if a child is acting out or doing something that's untoward and you try to discipline them, they'll immediately run to their mother, who's baked, and the mom will be, oh, it's okay. Come here.
Okay.
No problem.
I wonder if some counseling would be in order to help you deal with that and maybe even bring the kids in.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
It's a challenge. Yeah.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Jennifer Michaels is our guest. Dr. Jennifer Michaels to you. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. It's Medical Monday. We hit the home stretch coming up.
Support comes from Premier Medical Group of the Hudson Valley, gastroenterology and urology specialists with offices in Dutchess, Ulster, and Orange counties. PremierMedicalHV.com. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees. Offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. And Williamstown Theater Festival, Williamstown, Massachusetts, presenting the Marx Brothers musical Animal Crackers now through July 14th, and a new comedy, American Hero, now through July 17th. WTFestival.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551. I really enjoy talking to Dr. Jennifer Michaels here, and hopefully this will not be included in any hourly fee, the little chats we have in between.
Do I have to pay you for this?
Oh, no, I thought you are good, you. Monica in Albany, you're on.
Yes, hi. My question has to do with phobias. I have a 15-year-old who has recently, within the last year, developed phobias of germs, and she spent so much time figuring out, you know, who touched a certain item, and you know, who used the bathroom, did they wash their hands, and it's getting to be a little bit debilitating, I think. And I was wondering, what's the best course of treatment for something like this?
Well, it's great you're calling in and looking into options. Can you tell me, are there other problems besides this? Are there any kind of rituals or compulsive behaviors like washing hands 20 times, anything like that that you're seeing?
Yes, a lot of hand washing.
Yeah. So it sounds like your child probably would do best having a diagnostic evaluation, because your child could have a plain old phobia, or it could be more complicated, like an obsessive compulsive disorder. And so what we see with OCD or obsessive compulsive disorder is feeling like I can't go on to the next step, or feeling tension unless I wash my hands. I wash my hands and then I feel like I need to do it again, or I need to count to a certain number, and then the anxiety diminishes. And so without knowing your family, I would say that the best thing to do would to bring your child to a therapist and get an evaluation. There are lots of good treatments. Usually treatments involve a combination of cognitive behavioral therapy, that's a formal kind of therapy, and medication.
Okay, great.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you, Monica. We appreciate it. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Janet and Rensselaer, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I had a follow-up to the person who called with questions about going on an antidepressant in response to an anxiety episode. My question is more about the long-term effects of withdrawing from antidepressants. I had been on Celexa Wellbutrin for about 7 years, and my doctor felt that I would need to stay on it for the rest of my life, but I was having physical side effects, including osteopenia, tremendous weight gain. She also had added in lithium for a tendency to do sort of mood swings, you know, high energy to low energy. So I have been off of everything for almost coming up on a year, and in that year I've been experiencing a lot of anxiety and very difficult anxiety, and I've been trying various things other than the medicine to cope with it, to try to get it under control, including meditation, seeking a new therapy, new therapist, and now I'm trying some dietary supplements such as zinc and B6. And I'm hopeful that I won't have to go back on it, but so far the symptoms are still pretty strong.
Okay.
Can you talk about the long-term withdrawal when you've been on drugs like these for a long time?
Sure. You know, people will have some withdrawal symptoms. It's not life-threatening, and it's not like withdrawing from something like alcohol or Valium or opiates. But if you suddenly stop your antidepressants, you're at high risk for withdrawal syndrome, and it can be headaches, nightmares, or jumpiness. Your muscles may feel jumpy. You may have nausea. So the best thing you can do is taper off very slowly under a doctor's guidance. Never do it on your own.
I did do it on my own over a period of about 4 months.
Okay.
I went as slowly as I could. The main symptom that I have is really more anxiety. That when it comes in the form of kind of almost a terror, a kind of panic feeling. So I've been trying to treat it as an anxiety disorder and hoping that I won't have to go back on those drugs because the side effects were awful.
They were so bad. Okay, I'm going to throw out a couple of options. Another option is that when we're acutely ill, you know, suffering at the max, oftentimes doctors will give you a lot of medication to quiet the symptoms and to get you functioning and feeling better again. And then you stabilize. And it may be that a year down the road, one of those medicines can be removed or even all of them at a lower dose. And I've done that with my patients repeatedly. Some people do taper off, but if you've had a discrete severe episode, your chances of a relapse are very high. So if you've had, you know, two episodes of depression and anxiety in your life, if you go off your medicine, the chances are great that you'll have another episode.
Right.
So keep that in mind. The other thing you can do, or a few other things that will help, meditation has been shown to heal the brain. And mindfulness-based stress reduction is a way to help your brain to function better. Intense exercise every day can help. And so those are things that will help. Not eating, I always say it's bad to be prejudiced except for your food. Avoid white foods because those are the ones that make you kind of, you know, irritable and angry.
Really?
And fatigued. White foods are not good for your mental health. Things like sugar. Sorry, I know. We're getting rid of.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Huh. So look at your diet. You want a rainbow of food in your diet, and that will help your mental health, good nutrients. But I look at it this way. If you need antidepressants or you need something for anxiety, maybe you can do it in a very simple one medication way because you've done all this other good work to be healthy.
Janet, thanks a lot for the call. In general, either now or in the recent past, do you think that people were over-medicated? There were too many prescriptions being doled out?
I think that we are probably guilty of what we call polypharmacy, where, you know, Ray, if you had a problem, I would give you one medication, but you still weren't sleeping well, I gave you another, and then you had a side effect, and I give you medicine for the side effect. So some patients are walking around on seven medicines. Now, maybe they need that, but the ideal would be to simplify.
Yeah.
I worry about drug-drug interactions, and once we get up to seven or eight meds, all bets are off.
Let's go back to the phones. And Louise in Middlebury, Vermont, you're on with Dr. Jennifer Michaels.
Oh, hello, Dr. Michaels. I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease about 6 years ago, and I was given horrendous amounts of carbidopa levodopa by one physician. And at one point, he said to me, Mrs. Hamer, you don't have Parkinson's, but you have now contracted you're now hooked on the carbidopa levodopa.
Addicted, you mean?
Addicted, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
So the problem is that he wanted me to get rid of all the medication and not be on any. But every time I try to do that, I get these,
pill rolling tremors, they call them, or you have difficulty walking?
Well, I have a difficulty walking, but I also have, yeah, I have shaking in my legs and all.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm not making myself too clear. But
no, I think you're doing a great job.
Oh, thank you. But so my question, but you know, every time I try to tell him I can't, you know, I could use a little bit of carbidopa levodopa during the day just to get by, and everyone says no, you can't do that. You should go cold turkey. You should just, you know, stop taking this. So my question really is, how bad a drug is carbidopa levodopa, and is this a common thing whereas people get hooked on it?
So those medications, the carbidopa levodopa, are medications used most commonly to treat Parkinson's disease, which is a neurological disorder. I am not a neurologist, but I can tell you that I treat people who have Parkinson's, and that's the medicine they take. There are other medications that are used, and they're used to increase your dopamine level. I'm not equipped, you know, I don't have the specialty to provide suggestions other than to say, go see a second opinion. Mm. If you're not comfortable with the diagnosis, the medication, it means that someone else needs to evaluate you. It just sounds like it's not making sense that you're feeling you need a medicine and you're not getting it. And there are long-acting medications that may give you greater comfort and won't leave your system so quickly, so you have more of a smooth delivery of the dopamine.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. I'll try that.
Yes,
Louise,
please do.
Thank you very much. Dr. Jennifer Michaels is our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. And we go to Suzanne in Dutchess County. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. I just thought about when you were talking about kind of mentioning smoking, and then doctor was talking about collateral damage and using menopauses. I was thinking that anything that somebody tries to change, even if it's for a positive change, like giving up smoking, a lot of times, even if the people in the household are trying to be, or at work, are trying to be cooperative, if you don't get them on board, they can be upset by your behavior. For example, if most people, when they quit smoking, they're really obnoxious and, you know, they're anxious and uptight and angry.
Yes.
And all the reasons that they smoke, because it helps them with all those things they think anyway. And
I don't think Ray knows anything about that.
Are you kidding me? I'm like that now.
I just mean that the family or the other people want to help, and maybe if there can be some sort of language or agreed dialogues or certain behaviors set ahead of time, that might help, you know, where everybody's in on the same program. I'm thinking of those books, like, I haven't looked a long time, but Dance of Anger and Dance of Intimacy, where they kind of show you where one person, it's like a seesaw, when one person makes a change, it upsets everybody else's apple cart, even though they want to be on the same page.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, I just never thought of it in terms of, like, the word collateral and that why you want to bring in everybody to make a program successful.
Well, we know that when we bring in the family, the treatment is going to be more successful. And we also know when we bring in the family, if there's a reason it's not successful, it will come to light.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, there have been times that I bring in a family member, I'm trying to help someone get sober, and mom smells of alcohol. And then there's the mystery solved. Why it's so hard for my patient to stop drinking.
Yeah.
When mom's drinking every day.
Right.
So it's good to have that information. I can say in general, there is collateral work that will enhance the likelihood that the patient will be successful. So if we think about Ray maybe making the decision to stop smoking, we could work with his family so that they give positive reinforcement. They keep him busy.
Right.
They congratulate every little step he makes in his sobriety from cigarettes.
Well.
And I think we have a plan.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Doctor. Let's go back to the phones. And it's Jean and Troy. You're on. Hello, Jean.
Hi.
You're on.
I have a question about my son in his early 20s. He's always been pretty passionate and somewhat obsessive about things, but he was diagnosed with bipolar recently. And as an adult, it's hard for us as a family to deal with his care if he doesn't want us involved. So he's had some odd behaviors that have gotten him incarcerated. Hasn't hurt anyone, robbed anyone, but, you know, living homeless, things like that. And as a, I guess my question is, as a family, he's gotten some excellent care in institutions, but every time he leaves, he decides he doesn't need medication. You know, so it's hard for us coping, and that's my question.
It is so hard. I feel for you because I work with people with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia who really need help and then also really have a hard time understanding that this is long-term treatment. It's not, it's just not an episode. And we were talking about collaterals before. You are a collateral and you love your child. There are organizations like the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill that is there to support families like you. And it is made up of families who have gone through this and can be role models and guides so that you can look at issues of, you know, are there ways to engage a guardian or set up safety nets or notify your local crisis team so that your son never has to get to that point again? I urge you to contact NAMI or any local organization that supports loved ones dealing with mental illness.
I guess my frustration is, he needs care, not incarceration. But every time he leaves, it's a vicious cycle. It's been a difficult six or 8 months.
It sounds terrible. And I'm just thinking as we talk, also the Department of Mental Health can help you with that. I don't know if he's connected with an outpatient treater, but that...
He was doing that for a while.
Okay.
Between, you know, New York City treatment and then care here, but it's not been working out. So.
Okay. So you know, what also can help is a crisis plan. Like, he's mm-hmm. not where he's supposed to be. Let's kick in that crisis plan. There's a lot that a team can help you. So it's not all on your shoulders.
All right, Jean, we're losing you there. Some breaking up of the signal. Let's go to Josette in Cobleskill. Josette, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering about the state of research in regards to the brain and addiction to food.
Very good question. Uh-huh.
Is food considered a substance that you can get addicted to?
Yes. This is a very timely question. If you look at the National Institute of Drug Abuse and kind of peruse that site and look at food addiction, you will see scans of the brain that show a lighting up of your addiction center. And so they scan different people with different addictions. And heroin, cocaine, nicotine, food addiction,
yeah,
all light up the same place.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I see.
Yeah. So food can be, not for all of us, but for those who engage in it with it in an addictive way, can end up suffering a brain disease of food addiction.
So,
a physical disease?
Yes. In other words, that if you eat in a certain way and you think in a certain way, you will end up with a dysregulation in your brain so that when you eat, it's compulsive and it's extreme, just as though you were drinking in excess.
Everyone needs to eat, right?
Everyone needs to eat.
So wouldn't part of your physiology say, my brain is telling me this is good that I'm eating so that I eat my next meal and I live?
But food addiction isn't about living, it's about compulsion. And I can't stop, and it's out of control, and I feel almost high or euphoric or no pain when I eat in an addictive way. So it's fascinating. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no. Or your whatever you're feeling is reduced, whether you're feeling sad or upset or anxious. There's a reduction in those feelings, and a kind of, you know, contentment sort of sets in.
A numbing. Many people will talk about it as a numbing. When I eat, and, you know, it's in an addictive way, I feel numb, and they like that. It doesn't hurt anymore, and it's very difficult. In a way, it's easier, if you think about it, for an alcoholic or someone addicted to cocaine, they could live their whole lives and you know, never engage in those behaviors. Someone who has a food addiction has to eat every day.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're engaged with their drug of abuse, and they have to learn how to control it. And so some
now,
of, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm assuming that research is being done in different laboratories to come up with something that would allow, you know, you take a pill and the craving goes away.
We don't have that pill yet, Josette. We do not have it. It's more looking at, so we know that what the white foods, and again, as I said before, don't be prejudiced, except with your food. Avoid white foods like sugar and pasta and rice and potatoes, because those are the white foods give you a big sugar surge, and that's part of this whole you know, addictive quality of foods. You want foods like salads and lettuce, vegetables. Vegetables and colorful foods that are filling but do not have a rapid increase in your blood sugar.
Josette, we're out of time. So, in other words, is this physical manifestation merely something related to diabetes?
I think insulin is in play with this, but the addiction part is really in the brain.
Very interesting. Well, we're out of time. I'd love to get into this more next time, and Alan hopefully will do that for us, because, you know, he doesn't like white food either. He won't touch the stuff. All right, that's it. We're out of time. Thanks to everyone who called in. Thanks to Dr. Jennifer Michaels of the Breen Center for being with us. Support comes from the hospitals of the HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. Health-quest.org for locations. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who handled the engineering today. Brandon Holmes answered the phones. Thanks to all of you for calling in. Our producer, Patrick Nodges. Thanks again to Dr. Jennifer Michaels. That's it for today's show. Tomorrow, well, we're not sure. It's an open forum of some kind, and we will get back to you on that. I'm Ray Graff. Stay tuned for a news update.